show.
JD, Blake, Ailish Forfar.
Hump day.
No Toronto sports yesterday. Yeah, hump day. I'm in a weird I'm in a weird spot again where I'm a day. I can't tell if I'm a day ahead or a day back. Like, you know,
daylight savings really gotcha. Eh?
Yeah, it got me. It got me.
Can I give
it
you really a whole did. Day?
It got me. Although I gotta tell you, where do you guys land? So daylight savings time gotta go, right? Like in the States, they're basically, hey, this has to go. There's crazy stats about heart attacks and deaths and car crashes on the days after daylight savings times, right? Just the, like, seriously, people die from daylight savings time. No, what an intense way to start the show. I'm so sorry that I woke. Some of you are barely waking up. You're just getting in your cars.
Yikes.
You're just sitting down at your desk. You're putting in your headphones and JD just is like, some people are dying from daylight savings times of PSA. No, but seriously, it's one of those, I can't believe we know what we know about it and we still do it things. But also, I will admit that it's one of those things that's it's a universal experience that we all kind of bitch about together that I'll kind of miss it. You know, I'll kind of miss that little extra hour or of sleep that one time or that when we lose it.
Only
we
in the fall.
All grown. Yeah, the fall one is good, right? The fall one's basically hibernation. It's like, all right, sleepy heads.
Back into bed, my little teddy bear.
Yeah, all right, you guys need to sleep for the winter, and you get that extra hour. Daylight savings time, probably going to go away. I think it might even be already gone away. I don't know. Are you guys up on daylight savings times news?
I thought I read something, actually, because it was this weekend. I thought I saw something about the states had actually voted to remove it, but
we haven't.
So, like, what happens then if we don't move it and, like, California does and then games are four-hour differences? Like, that's all I thought of.
Oh, my God.
I thought of the game schedule if we're watching, like, the Raptors on the West Coast and we're like, no.
We got to quit.
The belief was that we would just do whatever the U.S. did.
Okay.
Apparently, the premier.
That's embarrassing. Now I'm going to be like propaganda for keeping daylight savings time so that we're different than the states.
The big question is, what do the Atlantic provinces do? Because they're in a time zone that doesn't exist in the U.S.
Oh no, you're
so
friends.
What happens to Newfoundland, where they're already in a weird spot, where they're an hour and a half off? They've got a half time zone?
Yeah. I'm going to die. That was the consideration. They were like, the Newfoundland delegation was like, what happens to us? What happens to us in Newfoundland when we have daylight savings time?
The rest of the world's like, go on strike, JD.
Yeah, exactly. The rest of the world's like, who are you guys? What's happening up there? Why are you doing a weird half hour thing? Who told you to do that? No one told you to do that. That's your own
Canada,
thing that you decided
keepers,
to do.
The keepers of the daylight savings and the nickel.
That's a really deep cut, but that's funny.
Only the true listeners will know.
I'll tell you this. Is like, I can't tell if I want it to be all of Canada that shows solidarity. Like, we're the last ignorant place that refuses to abandon daylight savings time. Or if it's just Newfoundland. Like, Newfoundland and Labrador, two of them together are just like, this is our thing. And when you go visit it, it's like, there's tourism stuff. Like, you go buy a daylight savings time forever.
You go buy a giant clock, like, and you take a photo. Yeah,
exactly. It's like
that's in a lighthouse.
Yeah, Blake, what do you think about rebranding where you're from this way?
Yeah. There already hasn't been solidarity in terms of daylight savings. Like my university roommate was from Saskatchewan and didn't know daylight savings time was a thing because they don't do it there.
No,
there's already not solidarity. JD, the Yukon ditched daylight savings a couple years ago. They were just like, forget it, we're permanently mountain
curve.
Time yeah,
you know what,
trendsetters.
I got to tell you that is unbelievably disappointing behavior from them to act in this way, to try to act out and get attention and leave Canada and our culture of having daylight savings time opposed to the States. Again, like, I just don't want it. Here's what we cannot do. I think we all agree we just cannot. If the U.S. passes it, right, we can't just next day be be like, all right, we're in. We're with you. We got to at least show some pride and make them wait a couple of days to reply to the text, you know? Or they're like, oh, I guess we're in too. Like, be cool about it, Canada. You know what I'm saying? Be cool
about it.
Well, I
say, don't even do it. Don't even do – like, don't even say anything. Just when spring rolls around, or I guess the next one's fall, just don't do it.
Hold on, though. You also
you don't need to make an announcement or anything. Just like, hey, yeah, we're done. We're not doing it.
Wait, though. UConn is permanently on Mountain Time? We're Pacific Time. This is news to me.
They're permanently on Mountain Time now.
JD, you don't even know. You this call is, your this family. Is, they're like, it's 4 in the morning.
I'm not even joking. This is earth-shattering news. So you're telling me we're with Alberta now? Like, we're in the middle? We're only 2 hours back, not the three?
Pacific Daylight Savings Time.
Yeah, PST. That's UConn. Okay, yeah. Because I was going to say, we're far west. Which, like, that's...
Yeah, this thing's wrong. And I clicked out the information link and it says Pacific. Sorry.
Okay, no, it's fine. I thought today I was going to lose daylight savings time and my whole life would have been a lie living in the wrong time zone. Like, imagine growing up your whole life being in the wrong time zone and then they tell you as an adult, like, this was actually the time zone you were meant to have. It changes everything. It changes everything. My entire TV schedule would have been completely different. Anyways, it is the Fan Morning Show. I'm JD, Blake Murphy, Ailish Forfar. Sheldon Keefe spoke yesterday, and he had a couple of interesting things to say, because we were spending some time talking about what the blue line pairings would be, and it was always with Jake Muzzin in mind, because everybody's assuming Jake Muzzin's coming back. He's progressing well, and so he became a big topic of conversation. He was central in the idea of whether or not they would use LTIR space to acquire something extra, whether they would be aggressive, and so it was just Jake Muzzin, Jake Muzzin, Jake Muzzin, Jake Muzzin. Secondarily, Rasmus Sandin was a very big surprise injury, right? Nobody really knew that was coming. We thought Andre Kasha was going to be going on LTIR. Andre Kasha has got to be one of the world's weirdest experiences I've ever had. I'm not even exaggerating here. Like, this guy has gotten absolutely crushed multiple times this year. I'm going to say, like, how many times did you guys guess Andre Kasha has gone to the dressing room and you've gone like, oh, well, that was like, you know what? They signed him for cheap and this was always part of the risk, is that he was going to get hurt.
Four
like
or five
six
times,
times?
Maybe. Yeah. I feel like that
could be higher.
Four or five, six.
I think four is low.
It's more than two. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's more than two. And apparently he's fine, though. And this keeps happening where everyone goes, Andre Kasha, RIP.
Ooh, that's
and
it.
Then,
yep.
2 days later, it's, hey, actually, this guy's fine. Like, he's like the Roadrunner, or sorry, Coyote in the Roadrunner, where it's like, it was like, oh, TNT, got him, RIP. Oh, you slammed into a tunnel or a rock that he thought was a tunnel, but was just painted black. Wow, Roadrunner fell for that, or got him again. And yet he keeps coming back. But Sandin is this just immediate... Okay, he's off the table, he's off the menu. And it sort of dawned on me yesterday that we hadn't really taken into consideration in a lot of these discussions, at least our show. I'm sure other ones did, but who cares about those ones? No one's listening to those shows. This is the show. But here's what Sheldon Keefe had to say about the blue line pairings yesterday, and I want to know if from you guys you find this a little surprising.
Keeping things lefty-righty made a lot of sense to us, and then at the same time, it maintains pairs that have been together with Brody and Hall and Riley and Labushkin, so we just thought it made some sense that way. I think, when Muzz returns, we'll probably get a different look at that time, but for right now, I think this makes a lot of sense for us to do it this way.
So here's what I think the pairs are going to look like. Obviously, Riley Labushkin, he said it there, Brody Hall, and then, Giordano looks like he's going to draw in with Liljegren. And, this makes sense because these are the defensemen that they have available to them, right? Like, this is what, this is the only real way that I think you can break it down right now. But it raises the question of, if Jake Muzzin ends up being out of the lineup for a very long time, do we now think that the third pairing could eventually result in a Giordano moving to his right side with Muzzin in the lineup. Like, I'm looking at this right now and saying, is there something where these are additions for guys? Or is this a scenario where you're just getting by until someone gets in and we have no idea because we're still going to wait and see how much runway Muzzin's going to get? And then it brought me to, well, what do we actually care about that could happen in the regular season? Okay? So we'll run down a few stories, a few topics, a few things. And if you want to text in or you want to reach out at any time, again, you know the socials, at JD Bunkus, at Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy on Twitter and on Instagram. But yeah, what are the stories that we care about the most that are in the regular season? Not the playoffs, but actually like what we're going to watch here down the home stretch, the remaining, I think, 20 games left of the Leafs regular season. So, but let's start with the blue line pairings. Blake, I'll start with you. Like, is there anything from this, like, what do you think about when you hear this is the way that it's going to be deployed for the foreseeable future?
I don't think anything too extreme right away because I think it's all going to be fluid. The biggest thing is we did this evaluation of where Giordano fits under the assumption that A, Muzzin would be back at some point, and B, Sandin was available. We didn't know he was headed to IR when we did our main Giordano breakdown. So that has required a little bit of reanalysis for me. What's difficult for me, and one of the things I'm curious about, and JD, obviously we've talked about this a lot, Liljegren has put up pretty good numbers no matter who he's with because of, in part, the sheltered minutes, because he can keep a defense in their own zone and things like that. Curious to see if him and Giordano are actually a good fit where Giordano offers a little bit of kind of safety on the back end, similar to why the Riley-Leobushkin pairing has been pretty successful so far. Riley and Liljegren with some of the same strengths and weaknesses, Leobushkin and Giordano both kind of floor-raising, more defensive-oriented guys. Obviously, Giordano does a lot more than Liobushkin, but it's 38 Giordano, one foot in the door we're talking about here. So that was the first thing that came to mind. The other is just a little bit of clarity on a question that I've bounced back and forth. And Ailish, maybe you could speak to it more as an athlete. I'm trying to think back to other work situations or when I played sports or whatever. I kind of thought they'd go Brody Giordano out of the gate because the idea of you hit the ground with familiarity to me makes sense as a let's ease you in, let's transition you. However, I understand it, and Keith is obviously leaning to the opposite side, which is we can fall back on that if this doesn't work. Let's find out about this first. So those are kind of my thoughts. I don't have like a like.
No, I think those are really good. I think that there's a lot to build off both of those thoughts.
Yeah, and so I think I thought the same type of thing with Giordano and Brody. Hey, reunite a pairing that clearly works. But now knowing that they're not going to do that, I feel like that's a good thing to have in your back pocket even. Give this a little bit of runway, see how it shakes out. And if it's not working, you have that as almost a surefire guarantee that they're going to play well together. There's so much history between the two of them. They're obviously best friends. And they're going to play well together. And so maybe you have that as a little bit of a safety buffer. In terms of your question, I don't know. I think that it's actually kind of a positive that we have so many different things that could happen with Giordano. And maybe the Sandin injury, which obviously is unfortunate, but kind of forces, hey, you know, Liljegren, you're going to have a little bit of an opportunity here. Maybe you weren't going to get that with the two injuries. I don't think you were. Let's see if Giordano can help give you a little bit of a boost. I think it was Born yesterday that was on the show that said, you know, you're not gonna play Giordano 20 minutes a game right away. And I thought, oh, okay, that's kind of nice. I expected him to come in and play big minutes right away and be kind of thrust into the environment. And maybe this is a good way to tiptoe him in there to get him comfortable. Even though he's a veteran, you know, it's a new lineup and such. So I think it's great, honestly, that they have these opportunities to mix things up. And I like the idea that Sheldon Keefe has kind of said, hey, we know this thing's going to work. Let's try something else. There's 20 games left. Let's find a type of chemistry that is going to work down the stretch. And if it isn't, we know that Brody and Giordano should work really well together.
Well, a couple things. One is, yes, just having depth. It's good to be able to take a look at all these things because, yeah, maybe there is a scenario. Hey, guess what? Based on Muzzin's past performances of not being able to stay healthy in the playoffs, good thing to get a look at this. Don't know what's going to happen with Rasmus Sandin, but all of a sudden you remove two of your top guys that both are left side and it becomes kind of an obvious picture, right? With your blue line, like this is sort of the way they had to do things, right? They weren't going to put Morgan Rielly back with Timothy Liljegren. I don't think that that was an option. They weren't going to put Liljegren with TJ Brody to start. Maybe like or they do at some point, but I wouldn't think that that would be something that after you get something out of Justin Hall, you're going to shake up. And then Giordano steps into, yeah, that sheltered role where he's in some... The thing is here is that when we're talking about this and we're breaking it down, maybe the Leafs are just going to be able to roll out a little bit more of a just your shift, next shift, next shift. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't need to do as much protecting of lineups. They don't need to just be overthinking matchups because there isn't the hard matchup group. I'm sure that they'll want to put Rielly in a more advantageous position, or Giordano and Timothy Liljegren, especially two of them, like both those guys, hey, offensive zone draw, they're probably still going to be in on some plays, mm-hmm. especially early on. But I do like the idea that, hey, you've got balance in your pairings now, but also it's like, it feels a little bit like, one, there's tryouts now essentially between Hall and Liljegren, that both of those guys get a real opportunity to fight for a spot here, maybe keep a pairing together. If Brody and Hall stay a thing, I don't know if they end up breaking that up. I figure maybe they roll that in the postseason. But yeah, you get a little decent look here, not only at this team, but maybe even at some free agency decisions too.
Yeah, we're not far removed from having the conversation, just the three of us on the show, about wouldn't it be nice to have a little bit of a set lineup where the guys can build some chemistry? And we discussed this, how it was maybe one of the reasons that the D looked so mismatched, because every night they were playing with somebody else. They were struggling to find that chemistry. And obviously they're elite level defenders, but there is something to say about, hey, you've played with somebody for three consecutive games. Like, you can read them better. You know what they're deficiencies are and how you can help support that. So this could be that stretch where there isn't a lot of flexibility, maybe a couple shuffles here and there, but let's play these lines for four games, you know, that they played tonight, and then they have a back-to-back coming up. So maybe there's a three-game stretch there where you can try to actually build some chemistry between these defense. So I think that's actually a really interesting narrative, and that's something I'm clearly interested in for the rest of the season when we look at the big picture of what the Maple Leafs can do with 20 games.
Yeah. The only nightmare scenario is if they don't work with one another, right? And then you start to jumble these up.
You're chasing your tail heading into the playoffs, mm-hmm. trying to find something that clicks.
Exactly. Like, I think that the ideal scenario here, weirdly now, is that, yes, Hall and Liljegren both end up playing so well that you're forced with a tough decision to bench one of those two guys. But I would guess that Liljegren would come out no matter what, and you would bump Muzzin. You would keep Muzzin on the left side and move Giordano to his right. Because there's a couple reasons for that. And I just mentioned that some of this is auditioning for next year. Lyubushkin is an unrestricted free agent. Mark Giordano is an unrestricted free agent. Justin Hall will be entering the final year of his contract at $2 million. Right? Or is he unrestricted next year? I think he's got one, Hall. I think he has one more year.
I
saw your face and I thought that was a you made a mistake face, and I went, oh no. I thought this was like when I thought Nichols were real.
Scary look.
Giordano and Lyubushkin are UFA, and then Liljegren and Sandin are RFA.
Yeah. So you've got two unrestricted free agents. You got two guys you got to give, four guys you got to give contracts to, but two unrestricted free agents and one guy will be on a very easily movable Justin Hall. Listen, if Travis Dermott just went for a third round pick, Justin Hall will go for more than that at $2 million on an expiring deal. That's just a fact. Okay, so that's not an issue to move. But I think you get a bit of a preview of how you're going to shake things out. And for Giordano, I kind of want to eventually move to the right side or be with TJ Brody, because that's my path towards staying with this club. That's my mm-hmm. path towards being with this team. I'm not sure, though, that they're going to want Giordano playing with TJ Brody for this reason. This is part of it, where they go, you're going to be 39 years old next year. If you're going to be with the Toronto Maple Leafs, we need you in a third pairing role. And so what's that going to look like? Well, that's going to look like you on your right side, bud, because there's no way that you're going to beat out Rasmus Sandin, Jake Muzzin, Morgan Rielly, and TJ mm-hmm. Brody, which brings the next question is the addition a look at life without Jake Muzzin, a reality where this team is trying to move off of his contract this offseason?
So in regards to who moves to the right side, I certainly understand that, like, let's find out who can move there for next year. I would say come playoff time and maybe even down the stretch, I think Brody's the guy who moves to the right. He's the guy who's done it most recently. He's the guy who's done it most effectively. So I think, you know, you're in a year right now where you got to eventually maximize. So I think Brody shifts to the right eventually. Longer term, yeah, the Muzzin thing is a real thing. Like, I don't think his deal's going to be particularly movable, but he's 33. He's had some injury trouble, two concussions this year. I don't know that you can write him in pen to be Jake Muzzin level. And like, he was struggling even before the injuries set in. So two more years at $5.6 million, I'm not saying Muzzin's done. I'm not saying you buy that out or anything, but I don't know that you're going forward believing, hey, we're getting the Jake Muzzin of 2020 moving forward. I just don't think that's a reality you can rely on.
I think if this ends up looking good, and then if and when Muzzin comes back and there is not a discernible difference, that's going to be the number one, well, one of the top storylines of this regular season. There's two other ones that I think are pretty clear and obvious that we'll hit on in a second that are going to be big down the stretch here. But it's getting harder and harder for me to see how Jake Muzzin's going to fit with this team moving forward. Like, if you can get Giordano on a minimum level-ish contract, right, as a left shot D who's going to bring you a physical and a veteran presence, how is it going to make sense for you to keep Jake Muzzin on the books for the 5.6 mil for two more remaining seasons? Like, if Muzzin can come back and establish his value, he might end up looking like there was a real time where when they had to re-sign Muzzin, that a lot of people thought he was just an own rental. A lot of people thought, okay, you acquired Jake Muzzin. By the way, last night I watched the Kings game. They play all those guys, and Dursey looks really good. And I just that trade was not as slam dunkish. That trade's not going to look as slam dunkish down the line as it did. Dursey's nice, like really nice. Big hit. I went, you're a guy who can hit? I thought you were just a guy who snaps around. Trevor Moore scoring goals last night. Anyways, he had this thing where you couldn't let him go. You had to give him that contract because he gave the blue line something that was so different. And even though you already knew that they had these guys that were coming up on a different timeline that were left shot D, Muzzin had to stay. He really was an identity player for this team. The Leafs don't feel like they feel like they're missing Muzzin right now. Like, you know what I mean? They're missing Muzzin, but you're not thinking about him all the time. You're not like, oh, and when Muzzin comes back. Blake, you mentioned it. He was struggling already. He wasn't playing with that same physicality. He has been getting hurt. You're always a little bit worried about him. I don't know what his value would be, how much it would take to get off of a contract that's like that for the next 2 years, what a negotiation would look like. It's also kind of tough when you have Peter Mrazek who's trying to work his way back, and that's $4 million. But you start to think about, well, you don't miss Jake Muzzin, and you don't miss Peter Mrazek, and that's like $10 million worth of guys you don't need. Maybe we shouldn't complain about John Tavares' money? Like, maybe we shouldn't complain about the $11 million that he has on the books, because that seems like that's a little bit more prohibitive. But either way, if these pairings look good, it's going to be kind of interesting how they phase Muzzin back in here. And your point about Brody is well put, and I think that it's a right one. I just can't help but think, like, it's not a great sign that my brain automatically thinks that when Jake Muzzin returns, you want to have him in a sheltered role. Like, you want to have him down the lineup and maybe be in that third pairing group. And then what does that say about the future?
I think that's also the nature of he's 33 and coming back off of multiple head injuries, right? Like, I think even if this were, you know, a guy who had still been playing at a borderline Norris level, you'd still be worried about those injuries and what he looks like coming back and want to ease him back in. So I'm with you on most of that. I don't know, like, you can never tell what the defense market's going to be on the trade thing. I do wonder a little bit if, like had you told me a couple months ago that had we had this conversation a couple months ago, I might have been concerned that Muzzin's an assistant captain. He's a guy with a lot of experience. He's a guy who's been through it. Giordano, if he's going to stick around, maybe insulates some of that as well. And then you hope, obviously, your own guys internally growing into more of those roles. Because $5.6 million is a lot of cap breathing room if there's someone out there who wants him. So,
well, listen, blue line depth is good. And I think most people would just point automatically to Justin Hall and say, well, you're moving off of Justin Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But I would think that both Liljegren and Sandin have futures here. Sandin was a no-brainer, no-move guy all the way through. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you're moving Liljegren because, again, he's going to be more valuable to you than another team. And what he's going to pay out on the market, unless you get something that's actually of pretty decent value, you want to see how this year rolls into another one, maybe with a little bit less sheltering. Who knows? Either way, if you believe in him, which they seemingly do, I don't think that this is a juncture where you're moving him. It's just there's a lot of names. Depth is good, but there's one too many names in this pile for moving forward where it's not going to make sense. And so this regular season, seeing how this plays out down the stretch, seeing how early Muzzin gets in the lineup, right? Is Muzzin going to get in the 10-game mark? Because it's pretty fluid in terms of, or unclear in terms of, hey, he's progressing well, but is that going to mean he gets in with 5 games left, with 6 games left? What's going to be the cost benefit here of where he slides in and who comes out and when? I think it actually is, after hearing those comments yesterday, I wouldn't have put it that high because I just assumed, like, hey, these are what the pairings are going to look like. I wrote them down as soon as the trade happened. And then it just dawned on me that, hey, this actually might end up being one of the most important questions for the now and for the future. So moving forward, are we done with this? Because I want to keep this going. Leaf storylines in the regular season we care most about. Ailish, what came to mind for you?
Okay, well, obviously I feel like goaltending is the biggest one. I mean, the easy answer
really
is I do have a backup option, but I know that like we should
there's
give
no
that
backup option. Do you say what you go with your heart? I don't disagree. I'm fully in the thing I care the most about is the heart. Like Shesterkin got lit up last night. He gave up mm-hmm. 7 goals to the New Jersey Devils. It might have cost
That's
me.
That's your wake and rake.
And no big deal, but the Rangers scored the first 2 goals of the game, and I just didn't even pay attention until all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is finally, thank you. You know what, Blake, thank you for just convincing me to take the money line. Now this isn't a sweat, you know, like this is just, anyway, blah, 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 blah. They lose, but Shesterkin, like, if you think he's the heart candidate, fine, go ahead. But I don't know. Austin Matthews, you know how many times he let in 7 goals this year? 0 times. Just saying. Anyways, back to your point.
The
net.
Goaltending certainly is going to be the biggest question, I think, for the Maple Leafs down the line. You know, even yesterday, we have a clip from Keefe saying something about Mrazek and how he's had a little bit of a tough couple days and now he's going to get an opportunity. And I think, Vic, you could play that clip for us now and we can talk right off after it.
Part of my message to Peter is that I was going to meet with him today. We're going to, you know, let him get his work in practice, and then we're going to kind of revisit it and see where he's at. He has been through, you know, quite a bit the last couple of days. You can imagine what that would be like for him emotionally, but I liked what I saw from him in practice today, and we'll look at it and revisit it, because at the same time, we've got a guy in Chalgren that has done a good job for us and came in at a time when we needed saves and we needed a goalie to give our team confidence, and he's done that for us, so we can't overlook that, because we've come to really believe in his ability to play for us too.
Okay, so certainly the question is Chalgren the guy you lean on down the stretch while Jack is still out? When Jack returns, is he the Jack Campbell that we've put all our eggs in one basket here at the trade deadline with the Leafs not obtaining another goaltender? Is that the right move? And I think that's going to be something we find out quite soon with 20 games left. If Jack Campbell is the Jack Campbell that the Leafs can rely on in the playoffs, if he's not, is Chalgren, Mrazek good enough? You know, even in the next 3 games the Leafs have tonight and then two back-to-back this weekend, it's already a question who gets the big Panthers game on Sunday. Are you kind of using the next 2 games as a tryout to see if Chalgren can play against the number one team in the East, or maybe even in one of the top teams in the league? I just think that is going to be the biggest debate about Leafs Twitter, Leafs fans, is did Dubas blow it by not getting a goaltender at the trade deadline? So that's a big narrative that I certainly care about just over the next
I agree.
Weeks.
I agree, but I think that one is still more playoffs. Like, I don't think we get an answer on the goaltending during the regular season. We're going to debate whether or not it should be Chalgren or whether it should be Mrazek come Friday. But to me right now, it's very clear and obvious. It's Chalgren. They just waived Mrazek. And I know part of that was the cap savings of $400K, right? But no, Keith said in that answer, you can't ignore that Chalgren came in and gave you saves when you needed him to. And so if he steps in and he gives up five in his next performance, then you talk about, okay, well, who's going to play against Florida? Because those points matter, right? Do you try to catch lightning in a bottle with Mrazek and hope he's motivated or whatever, blah, 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 blah? Yes, that'll be a discussion. But if Shogren steps in before that Panthers game and plays reasonably well, then it's a no-brainer. So I actually had one of my biggest storylines of the regular season, just Shogren, because I never want to see Mrazek in a playoff game. But I am curious to see what Shogren looks like down the stretch. If he gets more games, what is he going to look like for you? To me, you've already figured out what Mrazek is. And I know that Dubas said at his availability that Mrazek's never been this guy in his career, or he wants to get closer to the guy he has been his entire career, whatever. But no, actually, we know what Mrazek is. And this is what's so disappointing about seeing him play this way, is that he was this guy for a lot of his career. He was a bad goalie for a lot of his career. He is a guy who goes to extreme dips. I just want to see with this Leafs team that does such a good job at keeping teams to shooting from the outside and keeping teams to low danger chances, if Shogren can just be somebody who's in the net and makes the saves he needs to make. Because that's what this team needs right now. So Shogren, you are one of the most interesting stories of the regular season. Not so much the debate, not so much Jack, because to me, it's not so much a ceiling raiser, it's a floor raiser, as Blake likes to always use that terminology when we're talking about the Raptors and getting a bench, right? This is how I feel the same way, is a bench is good in a regular season. A backup goaltender is really good in a regular season. But once we get to the playoffs, who cares about a bench? You know, now you're into the Nick Nurse territory of your best six guys, and that's when it just becomes the real goaltending situation, is whether or not Jack Campbell can do the job. Because if he can't, who cares if it's Shogren or Mrazek? Both guys are not going to get it done. You're not winning a Stanley Cup with either of those two.
Yeah, you're toast if you're turned into one of those two. So I don't think it – I mean, maybe not. Maybe you get the random goalie gets hot in the playoffs thing. Shogren wouldn't be the first goalie who – has his flash in the pan in the playoffs.
Shogren would be the weirdest story in NHL history if he won. Like, honest to God, it would be, people would be writing 1,000 Shogren books about how
it's kind of like the Jordan Binnington turnaround, no?
Yeah, except it's in Toronto and Binnington had some pedigree and this would be quite different. Like, this would be quite the, and Binnington was like the guy from the, yeah. This would be a weird one. Sorry, Blake, I cut you off.
No, I wasn't going anywhere with that other than, agreeing that, look, one of those guys could click in an emergency situation like that, but what you're relying on there is not play based on what they've shown you so far. It's you're relying on the fact that sometimes goalies are random. And if you're doing that in a playoff series, well, you're, you know where you're playing from, and it's from behind, it's from underneath. So, yeah, Campbell is kind of the A1 guy from here, I think.
It's got to be it. So regular season storyline or regular season narrative that you care most about?
Of the ones that we haven't discussed yet, I would really like to see William Nylander figure it out. early season William Nylander was this team's best player for maybe 12, 15 games. He has been not only unimpressive statistically since then, but he's bounced around the lineup. We've talked about, hey, do you separate him and Tavares? Do you try him with Matthews? He's gone down to the, he didn't play fourth line minutes, but nominally down to the fourth line. We talk a lot about how this team is going to go as far in the playoffs as their top four will take them. And Nylander's been not unimpressive. He's got 58 points in 62 games. He hasn't had a bad season, but he has had a very noticeable tail off the last, 15 games. And I'd really be more confident in this team's ability to score throughout a playoff series if that second line can get back to doing something.
Yeah, I think that one was certainly a concern that I had as well, especially because we talked about this at the trade deadline. If the Maple Leafs don't get past the first round, it seems like William Nylander's time in Toronto would be over. He'd be the first contract if you're looking for something to change. I think it's not too out of the question that you keep a Matthews and a Marner and Tavares, and Nylander is the guy that you look to move to make a substantial change. So I think he should be playing for kind of his time in Toronto. I haven't seen that drive and that urgency that you would hope for. Yes, last year, in the playoffs, he was good, but we're talking about the end of the regular season here. We want to see you leading up to that opportunity playing your best. And it just really hasn't looked like William Nylander is even close to that right now.
And of course, as I say it, I look the stats up and he's got 8 points in his last six games. So I'm like, huh, maybe this has already started to happen.
It doesn't seem like that. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like it. And short of the Nashville game where they really, really leaned on him, and even then his line gave up a handful of goals at 5-on-5, I haven't thought, you know, certainly the trust doesn't appear to be there on the defensive side of the ice. And some of the possession metrics have gone the opposite way with pretty favorable deployment for that group.
Yeah,
and the Leafs.
No,
I was just gonna say Leafs are always touted as a two line team. That second line isn't really doing much. You can't rely on your third line to be, you know, always producing. So I think if that second line isn't rolling going into playoffs, what happens if there's a slump with a Matthews and a Marner? So you really need to just have Tavares and Nylander producing at a consistent pace. That's all I was gonna say.
So. Again, this is one where I agree with you guys, but from a regular season standpoint, it's not as high for me simply because Nylander played so well in the postseason last year that I kind of almost, I don't trust him, but he's always just been this dude that can elevate his game, that I trust that he's going to be better. And he's a playoffs and he's a off-season guy, but he does lend into, I think, the greater question, like Blake, and the points thing doesn't matter, especially, again, going into tonight, like they're playing the Devils on a back-to-back who have been letting in a billion goals. The Devils have a guy in net tonight. I saw the name and I went, I don't know who you are.
You really want to be out here talking smack about the Devils after last night? Be careful. Yeah, Nico Dawes.
Yeah, Nico Dawes. That's who's in net tonight. But what I am interested in with the four groups is just like how they do shake out going into playoffs. Like, what are the lines? Because even as we say it, what's interesting is, and I can kind of tie the Nylander thing in with Matthews' heart discussion, is I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that how much I care about Matthews winning the heart this year. It's just, but like my whole life, the Leafs have never had the best player in hockey. And we were always discussing like the value of Matt Sundin and how great he was. And you'd have moments where like Curtis Joseph had a real moment where he was one of the most valuable players in hockey. And you really looked at him and went, well, what is it? But he was a goalie and it is different. But for Matthews to have this dominant a season and to be able to grab a Hart Trophy in a world that has Connor McDavid and Nathan MacKinnon in it, I think that's like, Bill Simmons used to have this thing about how different trophies should be bigger based on the year, like the competition of like who you beat, or Olympic medals should be different sizes based on like the depth of field. If you win a Hart Trophy and those two guys are at the peaks of their careers, which they are, and both teams are playing extremely well, Oilers lost last night, but Oilers lost yesterday for the first time when they scored the first goal of the game. One of the most mind-popping, eye-popping stats of the year. I went, excuse me? It's March. It's the end of March. How is that real? Matthews gets that Hart Trophy. I just, like, that matters. I'm sorry, that matters. I know that this team is measured in playoff success and people are over regular season successes, but that's a different one. And I really didn't think that I would be invested in individual accolades this year, but I do really care about Matthews. But the point I was just going to make, Blake, quickly about how there is kind of an interesting conversation about the way Nylander's played, that you would just try him at least with Matthews. But if you do that, you kind of screw with his ability to win. Like, if we're talking about things you feel comfortable with going back to in the playoffs, who doesn't feel comfortable just going back to Matthews, Marner, Bunting? Like, what's the case? What's the case of, oh, you can't screw up the chemistry? Like, oh, yeah, no, Matthews being gone for two games and then coming back, it really looked like they were rusty. There's a real strong case from a preparing for the playoff standpoint that you would take an alternate look at who plays with Matthews and who plays with Tavares, given what we've gotten from Nylander this year. But if you do that, you potentially hurt Matthews' heart candidacy. And I don't know. It is weird. It is a little strange that they haven't pulled that lever yet. But either way, I do think that going into these last 20 games, seeing how the forwards shake out and what the battles are between the forwards is going to be fascinating, because they still don't really have a certainty like who should play left wing with Tavares. And it feels like anybody's up for grabs outside of Kerfoot in terms of who could be in and versus who could be out. And I guess Blackwell, too. He's here to play. But out of the rest of those guys, like Spezza, Simmons. But those Spezza and Simmons feel like they're fighting for a playoff spot. Like, those two guys feel like they're fighting for an everyday role on this team. Maybe the other guys are, too. But what the roles are going to be and what the minutes deployments are, it's like you could basically be looking at Alex Kerfoot. You're playing only a few minutes a night as the fourth-line center. Or you're playing closer to 20 as the second-line left winger. Like, those are big questions, and I think that they're only going to get determined with this. Like, this is regular season stuff.
So with your Matthews point, just to kind of close that out, I think not only is chasing the Hart and the first Leaf to win a Hart Trophy in forever a relevant thing, I think you can also look at, historically, just within the Leafs context, he's going to have a chance to claim best season ever by a Leaf. So he's already, you know, his 46 goals are the 10th most in franchise history. He's almost certainly going to break Rick Vive's record of 54. He's on pace. If he doesn't miss any more games and continue scoring at the same pace, he'd have 107 points, which would be the fourth highest in Leaf history. It's going to be tough to top Daryl Sittler in 78 and especially Doug Gilmore in 93. But league context-wise, Gilmore had 127 points and was seventh in the league in scoring that year. Like, the offensive environment was very, very different in that era of the NHL. So I think, you know, when you adjust for that kind of stuff, if you value goals a little bit more than total points, if this is a Hart discussion, it's also a discussion as best Leafs regular season first skater ever.
Listen, I think that this is a difficult thing to say as someone who was younger during Gilmore, like quite young during Gilmore's 93 season, and who never... I really don't mean to be disrespectful whatsoever, but the original six franchises and saying like that was the greatest season ever, I can't give it the same weight when there's six teams as a 32-team league. In a high performance, everyone's like not... Everyone is a professional athlete in this league. Nobody has a second job, right? Like, I'm sorry. And it's not that those seasons weren't great or that they don't. You can only be compared to your era, right? So, obviously. But no, if Matthews wins the Hart, and even if he doesn't win the Hart, actually, I think that this is already, let's put it this way. If he can close out these 20 games with any semblance of what he has done for the first 60 games, then it is the greatest season by a Toronto Maple Leaf ever. It is the greatest regular season by a Toronto Maple Leaf ever. I don't care how you put it. That's the fact that he's already the most talented Toronto Maple Leafs player. I think I mentioned this analogy before, but it's kind of like if you're a Leafs fan and you're somebody who cares about this team, you probably have a little hate for this team, especially if you're a bit older and you are a protectionist, maybe a little bit about the past or whatever. But It reminds me a lot of my love for Ray Allen and when he was the record holder of the greatest three-point shooter ever. But Steph Curry was starting to emerge as Steph Curry. And everyone went, Steph's the greatest three-point shooter of all time. And I went, no, it's disrespectful. Ray Allen is Ray Allen. And obviously, like, this guy was going to shatter those records and this guy was going to end up in a position that, barring a catastrophic injury, he was going to be regarded in this way. And now he is. And it's no slight. It's no slight to the past. It's just sometimes you get a supernova, and Matthews is a supernova. The Leafs have never had this, and so him getting this regular season matters. But yeah, is Blackwell going to be left winger? Are they going to move Nylander up to take a C? Would they move Bunting down to Tavares to just have a look and load up the top line? I don't know. It just, the forward groupings over the next 20 games are going to be fascinating, and I think that part of the reason why maybe they won't look at certain things is because that Hart matters to them too. Let's take a break. Big A-list today. Big A-list today. That's next. Fan Warning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Breaking down the top stories in hockey and Elliot Friedman every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's hump day. It's a baby A-list. Let's just go right into it.
Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
Okay. With no Leafs and Raptors on the schedule last night, I took the opportunity to binge a little Drive to Survive on Netflix season 4. Because I was a little behind. Well, I hadn't started it yet. So I got 4 episodes in yesterday. The intro episode, which kind of gives the rundown of everything. I don't really have much takes on that other than it's going to be one hell of a season.
You're going to go episode by episode here? Is that how you got it? You're like, first episode, no takes. First episode was electric. It's like Toto and Christian are like, hey.
Of course. But Toto, it just sets you up for what's to come.
Yeah, but Christian says Toto's not a car guy. He's like, he's a money guy. Oh, yeah, he doesn't know anything about cars. This is like one of my favorite trips of the season. It's such a good one.
It was a good one.
Yeah.
You feel for my guy, Daniel Ricciardo, when you watch the McLaren episode. He's struggling, you know? He's having a tough go.
Yes, he's battling.
He is such a character. You got to love him. You got to root for him. But after watching that episode and Lando Norris being kind of a little brat.
Okay. This is so great. Hold on. I'm gonna slow you down here because you're going to—this Blake and I are done, right? Blake, you're finished now? Blake's not done. Okay, he's muted, but he's not done.
I'm 4 episodes in.
You're both.
Oh, wait, that's where I stopped.
Yeah, I told you on the weekend I got the 4 and I haven't watched any more this week.
Okay. All so right. First of all, what I think we should be doing is there's 10 episodes, this. Unfortunately. So it can't be like this, you did the front 4 and now you're doing the back 4.
Cuz no, for a second I thought it was just like night.
One night. Okay. No, but I actually want to
drag this out.
No, but I think that this works because if you're a fan of this F1 series, if you're not, then you're missing out and I don't even care about you anymore. You disgust me. Like, you're not watching F1 now? Like, what else do you need? I honestly, if you're not in on F1 now, you're just trying to be cool and that's fine. People try to be cool in lots of different ways and this is one of the ways that you've chosen. Good on you. A lot of people have a lot on their plate. Make more room, you know. It's Thanksgiving dinner. Make a little bit more room. Like, no one's like, oh, mashed potatoes. No, Blake. He's like, I don't want.
Oh, Blake is saying no to mashed potatoes.
I forgot that Blake's like the only one who's like no on mashed potatoes. But okay, I love a night like this where you can casually watch other games, where you can jump around and keep an eye on a period here, a period there, or a quarter. Like, I watched a little bit of the Knicks Hawks. I jumped around and watched some of the other, I told you I watched Tampa Bay, Carolina. I saw a little bit of the Shesterkin meltdown. I watched the late night, threw on the Kings randomly against the Preds. Don't know why I felt compelled to do that. But I also watched a show. Like, I was watching a show. I was watching this FX show, Reservation Dogs, which is amazing. It's really, really well done. But yes, you went Drive to Survive. So you've done the first 4. You found, like, Lando Norris, you side, because most people think Daniel Ricciardo is such a cocky guy that they side automatically with Lando. You're the first person that I've heard that's team Daniel. Like, Blake, are you on Lando or Ricciardo's side of this? Because I that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still getting to know everyone a little bit. Okay. I don't, you know how I am. I ease in with the takes.
All right.
Little bit. I want to, you know, obviously these things get told from a certain lens as well. Mm-hmm. I find Ricciardo more interesting. I find him like what the situation he finds himself
in. Seven-time champ.
Yeah, like that's a more interesting arc to me.
It's a bit of a suitcase.
I don't have.
He is a suitcase.
Just car.
I want him to find a place where he can be cherished and he can thrive. So that's why I thought Lando was a little bit snobby. Not a fan right now. Hey, it's early. It's episode 2. But my biggest takeaway from my 4 binging episodes was that Nikita Mazepin is the absolute worst human. And his father, I don't want to say negative things about the Russians. I'm scared of them. But that entire episode, I was jaw-dropping at some of the comments. Like, make me a better car. Just make me a better car. And I'm like, but do you not understand? And then his dad thinking that the cars are rigged and that, you know, they're purposely putting him in a worse car. It was just nonstop shock. That whole, and I feel for you because I like the Haas team. I like their team, their family vibe. I totally agree with you. And they got this guy that is the complete opposite of their whole vibe, and I know that there's going to be some explosive stuff to come, but watching that episode 4, whoo, it was intense.
Also, an all-time worst fade, Mazepin. I don't know whose barber good. Is.
Yeah,
but
man,
it's like a chunky fade that yeah, that is in sections. I don't know.
No. He's got a really. He's got a bulbous head. Let's just put it that. He's got a very bulbous head. And to
he
have that
like
little.
One of those yeah. bad baseball teams that yeah. does designs in their outfield just to draw your eye to it and look good. I don't know what's going on.
I can tell you what's going on.
It's just not a good look.
I can tell you what's going on. He's got the. Is it Gunter from Simpsons? The,
yes.
The, like, I'm full of chocolate. Like, he's literally that head and haircut. Like, that's all I think of when I see him is don't poke me. I'm full of chocolate. That's Nikita Mazepin. Okay, so both of you hilariously texted me essentially the exact same thing about the Mazepin episode onto the separate sides when you both saw him. And listen, it is truly. He is now the poster child. Like, there's no one worse when it comes to professional athletes who are crybabies and who are entitled and who, like, I cannot imagine. Even if you were a diehard Haas Russian motorsports fan watching that episode and going, Mazepin's right. This isn't right. His family's paying a lot of money for this car. I will say this, though. So, listen, we're all on team hating on Mazepin. That's the only thing about F1 that. Is it you're splashed in the face with cold water of how, like, I get on golf sometimes and hockey, right, as two sports of the entitled, where it's so impossible to become a professional hockey player if you don't have any means. It's so hard to become a professional golfer if you don't have the access to the means. And I know the golf community gets mad saying you can golf for free. Yeah, show me all the poor golfers on tour right now. There's like a couple. F1. Boy, like, when you see that you can just get – there's 20 cars in F1, and there's just, like, how do you get one of those driver spots? Well,
your daddy
spends millions of dollars, and guess what? You can have an F1 car. It's just –
and then
and
threatens
you're not gonna be the
to
champion.
Pull it when he right. just – I'm just going to take the money out. Thanks so much because you don't like my son.
Were you surprised when the dad did that? Because I thought that the dad – oh, see, I was. I thought that was tracking towards, hey – his son is being such an over-the-top brat that his dad is going to have to give him the, hey, I'm paying a lot of money for these cars. We can't be having you not only crashing them all the time, but saying that the cars are different. This is crazy talk. Mick Schumacher is doing just fine in his car. Figure it out. And well, instead, when he Mick went the Schumacher opposite way, like, I'm going to pull the money move, I was floored. One of the worst – they're villains forever. They're villains forever. It's one of the worst – if you were those two guys and they put those out there, like, I know they don't care. They're above it. They're billionaires, right? Who cares?
Well, they spoke in a lot of Russian, I think, and the dad at one point was like, is this the camera crew? And they're like, oh, don't worry about it. I think sometimes he didn't think that they had translators.
We got to take a break because we are up against it. But yeah, I guess we'll never do a baby A-list again when we have to do F1 because the three of us now all have takes. Either way, we will figure out a way. I don't know if it's this week. I don't know if it's next for more of the F1 takes from Drive to Survive. We can't get enough.